Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Now, there's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish the book, I upload it. I do the review of the book and here on the podcast and upload it to a podcast feed for you people to download. The last book that I did, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, got a few fun bits of feedback from that, but I'm not going to go into the feedback. I'm going to get straight on as soon as possible to the review that I'm going to do today. Oh yeah, we set two pieces of news. One is that it's the 2nd of December, meaning November is over, meaning the National Novel Writing Month is over, and I this year completely failed. I only got about 25,000 words written, but I'll still have the novel finished quite quickly because I was expecting to. Let me put it this way: I wrote 20,000 words of the novel back in August and September, and I thought, well, I'll set this as a challenge to finish off over November, and I thought I was going to write a lot more of this sort of second part of the story, but it turns out to be just a little bit longer than the first story. I've still got a bit more to write, but I should be finished up within the next week or so as well. Also, since the last book I reviewed, I've read The Prince of Nothing, Book 2 by R. Scott Baker, and that was called The Warrior Prophet, and that was a really, really fun book. Well, I wouldn't say a fun book, a very, very interesting book, a very, very enjoyable book. Not the happiest read, but certainly very interesting. And it really set me thinking about, fantasy novels, because it's such a great book that I really wanted to talk about it and review it. But of course, this podcast is the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. So I put out a tweet on Twitter saying, hey, maybe I'm going to change the name of the episode just for 1 week only and call it the Speculative Fiction Book Review Podcast and just do a review of it anyway. But I'm not sure I'm going to do that. What I think I'm doing is I think I've read like 6 or 7 fantasy novels this year. So later on in December, I'll do a wrap-up and a quick review, like a 5-minute review of each of the fantasy novels that I've read this year in turn, just to give a little opinions about that. So hopefully that'll work out. And also, because I was reading this fantasy, and it's always really inspiring when I... well, not always really inspiring. Sometimes, you know, with my own writing, reading a really good book, it can be a bit depressing because you think, oh no, it's not, you know, it's this is way better than I can ever do. It's sort of like discouraging to do that. And other times when you read a book, you think, oh, I'd love to do this. And anyway, this book was a book that was really encouraging me to think about fantasy in a different way. Well, not in a different way, but in a deeper level. And there's this story idea that I've had for ages, and I've always sort of struggled. Well, it's more of a setting kind of idea. There's a story in there that I want to talk about, but it's always been a bit big for a science fiction novel because it's more of a, like a location kind of based thing with, you know, with the environment and things. And I was always wondering what could be like this science fiction hook that could really tie it in there, because I wanted something in there. I've got lots of other ideas for it. But then I realized, hey, what I should do is make this into a fantasy story. So I'm thinking of a novel to write next year. It will be a fantasy novel. And with that burst of inspiration, I managed to write about 6,000 words worth of notes in a new program that I'm using for note-taking, which is called VoodooPad. It's like an offline wiki program, like a standalone wiki program. And that's been a lot of fun to do as well. So anyway, let's just put that aside. I wasn't actually going to get onto those tangents, but too much. I was just going to mention that I read this Warrior Prophet book. Anyway, yes, get straight on to today's review. The book is Makers, and I just actually looked around to pick it up and hold it up, which I normally do with a book, but I read it on my iPod because it is a book that's been released as a Creative Commons EPUB book and HTML and all these other different kind of files version of it from Cory Doctorow. I reviewed his first book. I read it. He read and reviews his, well, his first book. I reviewed a previous book of his called Little Brother and quite enjoyed it. I'll talk a bit about that. Oh no, actually, I'll just talk about it now, actually, because I've made quite a few notes. And also, it's really weird making notes from this because it's all in a text document or in a HTML document. I can actually have it open in my browser here. One second, let me just open it here. So I've got the entire text of the novel right here in front of me. So if I need to skip to something or think about something, I can just do a Control F and find a word and hopefully find a passage that'll do that. So maybe I'll be doing that during this review. But otherwise, it's been quite easy to make a lot of notes because I can just do them right there with the stanza, and you can just annotate the book or put in bookmarks. So it's actually really easy to make notes while I'm going. So I've actually got quite a few notes today. Anyway, Yes, I was going to mention about Little Brother. I really enjoyed it. It was I gave it 4 stars, not for the novel and not for the story, but mainly because it worked very much like an interesting like a feed of interesting tech articles about computers and hacking and networking and security processes and lots of different stuff. So even though I knew quite a lot of it already, it was actually quite fun to read. The language was very well, you know, pitched because it was for a young audience. You know, it was a young adult novel and things like that. Overall, though, like I say, you know, the characters weren't very good and the story was a bit rubbish. You know, because the story of Little Brother is pretty much like after like the worst ever terrorist attack, kids get a bit snotty and piss people off a lot, and then in the end, they don't do very much themselves except they get to, except piss people off, and then they get like a friend of a parent is a reporter, and then she sorts everything out. So the kids don't actually do very much that makes a lot of difference in the end, except piss people off a lot. So it's a bit strange, anyway. Yeah, I gave it 4 stars, like I say, not for the actual story or anything like that, but for the, like I say, it's like reading Boing Boing, Cory Doctorow's blog, in a way. So what was I going to say? Yes, getting on to Makers. When I started reading Makers, I wasn't expecting great writing or characters or plotting or anything like that, but I was expecting something similar to Little Brother in the way that, you know, lots of interesting technology, and Cory Doctorow has obviously got a lot of ideas and, you know, theories and ways of talking about it. And thankfully, as this book began, I found myself in very familiar territory and really enjoyed it for the first part of the book. But the thing is, it's more than just the first part of the book. It's 416 pages. That's what it said on goodreads.com, where I was trying to do updates, because the thing is, on an ebook reader, you don't really have proper pages, you know, so it's difficult to know where you are in the book in terms of pages in the hardcover or something like that. So that was a bit strange. It's a new book. I've not heard anything about this. I've not heard any reviews or read any reviews or heard anything about it except, hey, it's a new book that's come out, and that's about it, really. So I was just thought I'd do it, and it was actually very good to begin with. Let's just start off. The world is this. Near future America, you know, internet's quite popular. Politics is, well, actually, politics really doesn't come into this novel at all. Actually, you know, I was just trying to think of what else comes into this. There's really not a lot going on in the world except the stuff that directly impacts the characters in this novel. There is, like, some new technologies and things like that, which I'll talk about later, maybe. But, you know, it's quite superficial. In other words, it's today, but a little bit in the future. And everything is just the same, except a little bit more so. There's lots of, you know, pop culture references put in there. And, you know, he's talking about Google and Yahoo and all these other things. Lots of Twitter is mentioned and things like that, which I think probably means it's going to date very quickly. Probably very much the same as Little Brother itself. I was actually thinking about while I was reading this book, and I'm thinking, yeah, I gave Little Brother 4 stars, but I'm thinking, like, for each year or each 2 years that goes past that first reading, if you read it again, it'll be worth 1 less star. And then in about 5 years' time, because it'll date so quickly, that book, because it's so now, it's so, you know, the technology is so current, that reading it in a few years' time will be painful. You know, like reading... I was reading this science book once, and it was talking about one day planes will be able to fly so high that we'll be able to bounce radio signals off them and to be able to communicate over longer distances than normal line of sight. And I was like, wow, that is an old science book. And I think that's what you're going to get very quickly with a book like Little Brother. And probably the same with Makers as well. The world is, like I say, quite basic. The plot, 3 parts. Just talk about the first part here. It is quite interesting. You've got Kodak and Duracell, and they get bought out by this one guy who buys them and combines them into a company called Kodacell or something like that. And this guy's name is Kettlewell, and he's like the main businessman. And he sets up this new company, or gets this company, and the idea is that he goes, right, what I'm going to do is I'm going to lay off everyone who's like a traditional worker, and I'm going to employ new entrepreneurs, inventors, makers, if you will, people who make new technology. And for each little team of makers and inventors, I'll put them together with a little reporter, a business person to report back to me. And you know, send the money and make sure the business makes sense and things like that. And this is actually quite an interesting idea, and there's quite a good scene at the beginning where, you know, they've got this new bit of technology, this Kettlewell and this blogger reporter who's like getting into a debate with him called Suzanne. She's a main character in the book as well, and they have this debate using this new piece of technology. And I was like, hey, this is really good. It's quite engaging and stuff like that. And also I quite enjoyed the whole kind of setup of a new business model. It reminds me of the part one of the Accelerando novel by Charles Stross. It was called Lobsters. And again, I really enjoyed that first short story of Accelerando called Lobsters, because it's about the guy who goes out and he makes people rich, and he doesn't make any money himself, but he makes people rich. Now, this is sort of like the opposite of that. You get one rich guy going, right, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to leave the ideas up to other people. I'm going to be the funding behind it. So you get a sort of that top-down leader in innovation and new technologies rather than the bottom-up way that it was in Lobsters. And so then what we do, Suzanne, this blog, reporter from the West Coast, she goes over and spends her time in Florida and meets the makers and meets her makers. No, she meets the two makers, which again, these are the two main characters, or two more main characters in the book. One's called Perry. He's like this youngish guy and he does tech stuff. And then you get this big fat guy called Lester and he also does tech stuff. Again, very strangely, that I was often wondering what their expertises were or why they worked together, what the history was together. You know, it's not very well explained. And then when they're down there, the business guy comes along. His name is Tian, I think it is. T-J-A-N, Tian. And he's the business guy. And he comes in. And the business goes well, and you read about them inventing stuff, and they make money. And also they make life better for the local squatters, because they live down in sort of like Hollywood in Florida, which is very strange because I've just been to Florida. I'm heading back there now on the cruise ship, and you know, it's set between Fort Lauderdale, Miami, that area of Hollywood. And actually, it's quite strange when you're driving down there. That's, I think, the only place I've ever driven past a billboard, and on one side of the billboard it said it was like an advert for a gambling helpline to stop you, like, quit, you know, like to make you quit gambling, to help you get over gambling. And as I drove past, I thought that was interesting. I looked back on the other side of the sign, and it was a sign to the nearest casino, and I thought that was just hilarious. Anyway, that's the kind of area that they're dealing with, that sort of like northern Miami, southern Fort Lauderdale kind of area there, all falling to bits because all the pensioners who move down there, they're all dying off and nobody else wants to move down there. The whole place is falling to bits, and these guys live in a what do they live in? Yeah, it's sort of like a scrapyard. So they live in a scrapyard, and they're using the stuff there, and they invent stuff. And now I don't actually want to go into too much of the inventions, because, you know, that's what this interesting part of the book is. It's about the new ideas, and it's about, you know, like say, they make life better for the locals and all these different kind of stuff going on. It's really quite enjoyable. Of course, the hero of all this, you know, isn't the person who's doing the money, and isn't the people doing the inventors. It's the blogger, the Suzanne, who's there, and it's quite sort of wish fulfillment writing by Cory Doctorow that, you know, the blogger seems to be the hero for getting the word out and making it's down to the blogger for making the company succeed, because then, you know, because of the extra press that this one blogger gives them, that suddenly everything's going right. And I'm like, yeah, okay, this is very good, very well done, Cory Doctorow, you know, write yourself up here, which is actually quite funny. I don't mind that. You know, in the story I'm writing, there's a juggler, and the juggler is awesome. But it's a little bit weird in this way. But you do get quite a lot of good stuff. All of it, really enjoyable. Cory Doctorow has lots of really good ideas, and he talks well about the impact of technology with the world and on people and with this new business model and all the kind of stuff that goes with it really, really well. Really enjoyed it, very much so. Except that was only part one. Then we get part two. And skips forward a few years, but, you know, there's a bit of an aftermath of what's happened in part one, but suddenly we get this whole new raft of new characters, along with the characters that we've already had. So we've got Perry, and we've got Lester and Suzanne, but now suddenly we get Sammy, who's this guy who is like an executive at Disney World, and we get this goth called Death Waits, as in spelt Death Waits for no one or something like that. And we get this, the Hilda, and then we get the family of Kettlewell and the family of Tian. And then, you know, and so it's really weird that we suddenly get all these new characters. It's like suddenly Corey's gone, oh, wait a second, I wrote this as a novelette, but now I'm going to expand it out to a novel. So I get these characters, but they're not actually interesting enough to do anything with. So let's bring in these other characters to suddenly give them new things to people to hang out with, and new people to have long conversations with. And, you know, because each character has to have at least one long conversation with every other single character in the books, then you get all these different, you know, lines of connections between different characters, and all really, really boring. And the rest of the novel takes a turn for the worse, let me put it that way, because the focus suddenly goes no longer on the people who invent. Of course, these are like almost retired inventors, you know, they're inventing stuff, but suddenly that whole kind of business model seems to have collapsed in some way. And Instead, Lester and Perry are just running this sort of fairground, you know, roadside attraction ride. And it's like this museum, and you go in and you can have a look at stuff. And you go, like, it's like Dig, where you can dig stuff up and it gets displayed more, and then you can sort of dig stuff down and it gets buried a bit more. And it's just boring. And the whole rest of the book is about this fairground ride where you go round in like a wheelchair and look at stuff. And then it's sort of like, wow, and it becomes this cult thing, and everything's amazing. And I'm just thinking, it's just a fairground ride, and I just don't care about it. And, you know, it just goes on, and they get with all these little things happening, you know, they have to compete with Disney. And then it's sort of like they're worried about selling out, and they're worried about people copying their ride, and, you know, the police come and try and shut them down. And then they get legal threats, and then they get legal threats, and then there's more legal threats, and then there's copyright infringement, and then there's legal threats, and then there's, you know, this and that, and then there's more legal threats. And oh, it's on and on and on and on about, you know, the minutiae of making this ride and then setting up a new one somewhere else, and then some new ones, and you go, oh, like that, and suddenly, you know, there's a natural disaster. And I'm like, wait a second, where did that come from? They go out to the beach, and suddenly this hurricane hits, and they're like, oh, man, we should have checked the weather. I'm like, you can't just... And then that gets the ride gets wiped out for a week because, the hurricane comes through, and I'm like... You can't just suddenly go, oh, let's just go to the beach. Oh, hurricane, shit. Oh, man, the ride's broken now. And it's just boring. And it's just because I don't give a shit about the museum. I don't give a shit about this ride that's taking place. I mean, I could give a shit about it. But the point is, compared to part one, where, you know, this new business model that they put in place, I don't want to give too much away, but it's sort of like it impacts the entire nation. It's like a whole new way of doing business. It empowers the poor of America. It empowers like 20% of the nation to make a new life for themselves, and gives them new tools and gives them direction and stuff like that. And, you know, that whole first part is really interesting because it's got some impact. And the second and third parts of the book, the crisis, each crisis never lasts for more than 10 pages. And it's a crisis about something I don't actually give a shit about. And, you know, when they go, oh, this is going to happen. Oh, and they solve that little problem. And it's sort of like, oh, and this happens. Oh, and they solve that little problem. Oh, and this happens. And they're like, oh, don't worry about it. It'll fix itself. And this happens. Oh, so, okay. It's like nothing is hard for them to get over. And I'm just thinking, these people are never going to meet a problem that they can't solve within about 20 pages. And it just keeps going on and on and on. Like, for example... They like these new things come online down in Brazil and it overloads the servers or whatever. You know, I don't want to spoil it too much. I mean, put it this way, don't read this book past part one. But if you do, you just get to this point and it's like, oh, it's annoying. And anyway, I was reading this book and Kettlewell's wife at one point, they have like this crisis of in their relationship. Let me actually just open this. If I just type in crisis to crisis, I made a note of this one. Yeah, so like this, she goes, it's not going to work, you and me. I can't live like this, lurching from crisis to crisis. And I'm like, that is what this book is. It's just a group of people running a roadside attraction, you know, tourist attraction, lurching from crisis to crisis. That's what the story is. That's what this book is. And it's just boring. It's just, there's just nothing going on. It's just like, oh, wait a second, let's now talk another time about legal threats and get the lawyers involved. And now is Disneyland again is going to come back and want this to, oh no, people are going to be violent about it. Oh, it's just stupid. And then it comes to the ending. And the ending is just stupid and petty as well. It's like, there's this main guy who's like the person behind 80% of this ride's problem. And like, it's like, he's the main... Well, he's not even the main bad guy, but he somehow goes through this transformation. Suddenly, everyone's really happy dealing with him. And then you get this stupid comedy journalist villain called Freddy, this British tabloid, like, technology tabloid journalist or something, who is just this parody of a stupid... you know, controversy-centered blogger who is just there as a troll. That's all he is. He's like an internet troll, and he's suddenly one of the main villains. And, like, the whole end of the novel, or the whole, like, you know, the whole, like, last act, really, is just about them ridiculing him because, you know, they wanted to make him look stupid. The thing is, he's not that stupid, But and the only way that they can trick him into make him look stupid was just lying to him and then exposing him when he said, oh, my sources are saying this. And then they're like, ha ha, you got it wrong. When they were the people who lied to him to make him get it wrong in the first place. And I'm just like, it's pathetic. It's cheap. There's nothing there at all. And what they all do at the end, it's like I'm looking at literally reading the last few pages, you know, of part three going, this is pathetic. Is this actually what I've spent 400 pages with? No, actually, forget the first part of the book, because that's set years in advance, and then you take this break of a few years, and then it's like the last, you know, the previous 250, 300 pages here. I'm just thinking it all comes down to this, and it's just pathetic. And then after that, even worse, then you get this epilogue, and it's the most down, dreary, depressing epilogue I've ever read. It's, you know, because normally at the end of a book, it's like, and everyone lived happily ever after. Now, you know they don't live happily ever after. You know that, you know, when the lovers get together, it's probably going to be okay for around about maybe 4.5 years, and then she'll say, oh, well, actually, I don't love you anymore, and, you know, and then she dumps you without any warning and stuff like that. That kind of stuff happens to the sort of, like, the fairy tale romances that take place in life. But you don't need to stick that in the epilogue. It's just sort of like, yeah, I'm ill and I'm going to die now. And it's like, yeah, everyone does that. Oh, yeah, and we split up. It's like, yeah, really, that's good as well. You know, the inventions that I had, they were ineffective. And I've been ineffective. And me too. I've just faded into obscurity and nobody knows who I am anymore. Yeah, my life has been a failure since the events at the end of the novel. It's like, I don't want to read all of that. Don't tell me that everything that I've been fighting for is just like, And I'm just reading these last sort of like 15 pages of the book of this epilogue, just going, oh man, what a downer. It's just terrible. And I'm just like, this is, it's just all over the place. And also, not just that, but the pacing of this novel is terrible. It's like, you know, you get these whole long passages where, you know, stuff is happening. And I'm going, oh, okay, well, I guess this is sort of moving the plot forward. And then you get this whole thing about the family comes in. And I'm like, what's this family doing here again? And then this stuff happening. I'm going, so why are we learning about this? Why are we spending time with this character over here? And this character has no impact on the story at all. So why are we spending time with this person? And then it's sort of like, then they go for a trip. Like these two characters suddenly go for a trip to Disneyland. And suddenly it's like Disneyland been the main villain all the way through. And then they're like, actually, you know, Disneyland's not half bad. And then you get this huge passage, which is just a verbatim blog post from Suzanne, who goes to Disneyland and was actually like, no, I really didn't want to like this, but actually it's really good here. And I'm just like, why do we need to? And to be honest, I did skip that part. I just thought, well, I see what's going on here. It's like Cory Doctorow doesn't want to get into legal trouble from Disney, saying that Disney is the evil one in this book. So in the end, the evil one isn't Disney. It's the bad reporter. It's the bad British journalist. And actually, Disneyland's all right. It's not too bad, actually, even though that's been the old pattern. I'm just reading it thinking, this is terrible. So the pacing is all over, really dragged. Like I say, the first part is good. Just read part one. Do not read parts two and three. And certainly, if you do get to the end of that, don't read the epilogue for, like, the massive downer at the end. Anyway, so that's what I'm talking about, the plot and the story. It is really... And like I said, there's no overarching one crisis for them to work towards. Like I say, it's this thing after thing after thing that they're just lurching from one to the other, and there's no one character that, well, actually, I'll come on to characters now. The characters, none of them are that attractive. All of them are a little bit boring, and most of them are pretty vague as well. Like, I couldn't always work out, I said before, you know, Perry is a technician and invents stuff, and Lester is like this technician who also invents stuff, and at some points, and you know, they're running this ride together, and one of them will go in. I'm like, oh, so who's running the ride now? And then I sort of flick back, scroll back a few pages, and I'm thinking, oh, okay, Perry's the one who's suddenly interested in the ride now. And then I skip, I was like, oh no, Lester's now. And I'm like, so which one is which? You know, which one is the one that's really driving and really cares about the ride? Because then at the end, the one that you're thinking was good, and then he goes off and leaves the other one. I'm just thinking, well, make up your minds, guys. And then it's sort of like, okay, so which one does this person fancy, you know? And there's like this thing, and I'm thinking, like, oh, okay, that's a bit weird. And then like these other characters, I'm like, so is she falling in love with this guy or with that guy? And why should she fall in love with either of them? Neither of them are that interesting or anything like that. The comedy villain characters, I guess they sort of stood out a bit. But you get Suzanne the reporter, a bit bland, you know, just trying not to be offensive all the time, always like, oh yes, I'm going to be fair and I'm going to be honest and I'm going to do everything. It's just like, and like I said, the makers themselves, Perry and Larry and Pester, I could call them, you know, didn't care what they were doing. There's two businessmen as well. You got Tanglewood and Tingle Tong, and they're just sort of like interchangeable, because sometimes one of them's the good guy and one of them's the bad guy, and then suddenly they swap around. I'm like, okay, which one do I really care about? And then the wives of the businessman, and I'm like, these are two characters which I'm like, why are we spending any time with these two characters? They suddenly just turn up, and they've got kids as well, and I'm like, wow, what are these kids doing here? And suddenly for like a quarter of the book there's children and little girls and little boys and stuff. And it's like Cory Doctorow, he wrote them in and didn't actually realize they were going to become a part of the story. And then it's sort of like, oh man, I can't get rid of the kids. Well, I guess I got to stay there. I've got to give them names. Like for like 8 or 9 pages in a row, they're called the little girl did this and the little boy did that and the little girl did this and her brother did that. And her parents are there. They could have said, oh, this little boy's called Pascal and this little girl's called Anna or whatever the name was. I can't remember now. And it's like, well, they could have just introduced them, but no, little boy, little girl. And then Cory Doctorow has gone, oh, wait a second. What we should do is I should give these kids names because they're probably going to be around in the book a little bit longer. So they're, you know, it's a bit weird there as well. You get Hilda, which is the girlfriend of one of the characters there. She's just perfect and sexy and perfect, but like a bit annoying at the same time, really sanctimonious as well. And always like, very like everything's going to be perfect. Oh, everything's good. Like principles before people and everything like that. And it's just a bit annoying. And you get Death Waits, the goth kid who's a stereotype. So he stands out, but only because he's got the label goth, and you sort of know what that looks like. When you say blogger or reporter, you're like, vague, a bit like that. If you say businessman, it's like, vague. Wives, it's a bit vague. Like, technician, it's sort of like, yeah, well, we never actually knew what they wore. Did they wear, you know, dungarees with slide rules or something like that? But then you get Death. He's a goth with black makeup and white makeup, and I'm like, oh, okay. Can sort of understand that as well. So yeah, that's a bit weird as well. And they say, and all the characters, they sort of just all speak in pretty much the same voice, and they can have this long conversation. You're just like, I don't even know who's talking anymore. It's a bit weird. And the other times they do stuff as well. Let me type. I made a note here. Emotional 10-year-old. Let me type this in to see what part of the book I was doing here. Emotional 10-year-old. Oh yeah, okay. Let's see here. Oh yeah, Suzanne, at one point, she goes, one person's working something, she's getting angry and he's getting annoyed and stuff like that. And she goes, I can't, you're in here playing with your Coke cans, his little mechanical Coke cans he's inventing. He goes, she picked it up and shook it. He heard the works inside rattling and flinched towards it. She jerked it out of his reach and threw it hard at the wall. Hundreds of little gears and ratchets and rods spilled out. Fine, Lester, fine. You go on being an emotional 10-year-old. And I'm like, wait a second, she just picked up his invention that he's been working on for the last week or so like that, and she shakes it and throws it against the wall and it breaks, and then she says, you go on being an emotional 10-year-old. I'm like, wait a second, what have you just done, and what did you just say? And I'm thinking, this kind of thing happens throughout the book. It's sort of like, they'll say one thing and then immediately go against. I'm like, is he being ironic here? Is this sort of like a comment on human nature? But it's a bit weird because it's really vague and things like that. It's like Sammy, who is this, he's a villain for part of the book, and he's like this executive at Disneyland. And you're never quite sure who he is because he's there and he's sort of like this guy and you're like, oh, okay, so he works at Disneyland. And you're like, oh, he's an executive at Disneyland. And then he's doing like stupid, stupid stuff. And he's like, oh, he's very clever and he's sharp and he's a businessman. He's really clever. And I'm like, well, for someone so clever, he's a bit of an idiot. So that was a bit weird as well. So anyway, characters a bit meh. But again, I didn't read this for the characters, but they were very, very annoying and very, very bland as well. It's amazing how you can get so annoyed with someone or a group of characters who are just so forgettable in some ways as well. Anyway, moving on to the tech. What do I normally say here? Yeah, science and technology. It's actually a good part of the first part of this novel. Oh, it's an interesting factor, a very interesting factor in the first part, the good part of this novel. And I'm not, and again, because it's the good part of the novel, I really don't want to spoil it, because that first part of the novel is about the inventions, and it's about the inventing process itself. It's about the guys going, okay, we need to invent this and we need to do that. So I don't want to actually give away the tech that they invent and the things that they come up with at the beginning there, except for the concept that Kettlebelly talks about at the beginning of the book. He says, you know, he brings out this little widget and he says, this hasn't been invented, this has just been made. The parts have already got everything that we needed to make this little widget has been there already. All you need to do is put it together, and with today's technology it's really easy to put stuff together. And I actually quite like that, you know, when if you're a maker, it doesn't mean you're necessarily an inventor, even though that's blatantly what you are, but the ethos behind it is like, oh well, it doesn't matter what it is, I reckon I could just probably make it, even if it doesn't have a use, you know, even if it's like an art installation correlation or this or that. You know, it's just the new way of putting something together in a new configuration is the interesting part. And I actually quite like that. And that's sort of talked about a bit at the beginning of the novel here. So you get like this sort of like low budget skunk works going on there, where the guys all going, and they talk about the little, what do they call it, the little radio chips. I can't remember. It's the radio thingy chips, and that's a big focus in Little Brother. And in this novel, they just go, oh, it's, you know, there was this thing and there was this technology that sort of faded out of use because there were privacy issues and nobody liked it. So we should find a use for them because, you know, nobody uses them anymore. And I actually quite like their little comment about, you know, it's like the people in Little Brother won, and, you know, these chips, which were such a bad idea in Little Brother, are no longer used anymore. And then they put them to good use in this novel. So that's really good. And, you know, they got these, you know, these bits and pieces of this, the 3D printer. That's what a lot of the focus of this book is about, these 3D printers that you can print anything with and stuff like that. And I was actually thinking, after part one, that part two would be all about the printers that can print themselves, because that was seemed to be what they were heading towards in this first part of the novel. But then what happens in the second part of the novel? It is mentioned a little bit, but then it just doesn't go anywhere. And they've got all these problems. And I'm like thinking, they're trying to make money and this and that. And, you know, people have printers. And I'm just like, all the time, well, what about the printer that could print another printer? Why weren't you going to do that? I mean, that's technology that actually exists now. You know, it's probably exactly the kind of thing that you can read about on Boing Boing, is the ideas where they have these printers. And you can, I think now you can print 90% of the same machine that you've just printed out again. Excuse me, I've got to sneeze. I mean, that's there already. And all the way through, I'm thinking, well, why don't I do this? And then at the end of the novel, it's like one of these makers comes up with this idea, and then, like, someone else is going out, like, the business people are going, oh, this is amazing. Let me say, I think they say it's obvious now. Let me just type in this into the book, see if I can find this here, and I'll just read out this little passage. Obvious now. Ah, yeah, here we go. Obvious now. Hey, it's great to just be able to search through the book like this. It goes... he goes, it's what it's like, it's alive and reproducing itself. Don't tell me this never occurred to me. Honestly, no, it never did. Mr. Banks, you have a unique, twisted, fucked up imagination. And I can say that with the warmest admiration. He goes, so obvious now that I see it. Yeah, it's like all the great ideas are like that. They're so obvious once you know it, once you see it. And I'm just thinking, like, we knew about this. You mentioned this same concept halfway part of the book. You mentioned this, and it's obvious there. And I've been wondering all the time, going, why aren't they just doing this? You know, they've got all the technology. Why aren't they just doing, like, printers? Sort of like they're going, oh, man, we've got to rebuild this building. I'm like, printer that can then print a building. And, you know, they're going to say, oh, just print something. And because everything is so easy when they actually want to invent something, they can invent it in a day. I'm just like... make a printer that can print itself, and make a printer that can print a bigger printer, or make a printer that can make a smaller, more detailed printer. And it's just there in this book, and it's just never even mentioned until, like, this part right at the end of the book. And then, of course, you skip forward to the epilogue, and it's like that's never even mentioned again. So it's like a complete and utter failure of the imagination, and yet failure of the writing as well. You can't suddenly say, oh, that's amazing, I didn't think of that. Like, this is a guy who's in the business of 3D printing. That's his business. That's what he's just made billions of dollars from doing, is distributing a three-dimensional printing machine. And then you can't just say, oh, I never thought about you could print a printing machine with my printing machine. It's like, that's what you do with a printing machine. That's why nobody, you know, that's what the race is, you know, is to make these things. And otherwise, this is, it comes down to it as well. You get these great predictions, and you get these great... technologies and inventions in the first part of the novel, but then you skip forward a few years and you think, well, if that's the amount of invention that's going on, like, Cory Doctorow's presumptions and assumptions and predictions of the future is really, really pedestrian. It's like he going, oh, and this mail was delivered today, and I'm like, wait a second, so in 20 years time, we're still going to have a postman that delivers mail, and they're going to deliver mail that you then throw out? It's like, I live in a major city, I live in a capital city, so I still get junk mail, but not if you live in a squat down in Florida, nobody's going to deliver mail there. And if you do get mail, it'll be a big thing because someone will come up to you like a telegraph was. You know, it used to be, it'd be a big event. Someone would come up and give you something. It's like, yeah, someone actually cared enough to send you something which required printing it on a bit of paper and then getting someone to hand it to you in your hand. That's a big thing. But then in the future, junk mail is just something that comes every day. And I'm like, wow. Wow, the postal service is still working. You know, and there's this other guy. He loses his laptop for a few days, and then he gets it back, and it's like, oh, man, I've got to download all this email. And it's like, has Cory Doctorow never heard of Gmail? Like, if I lost my laptop, you know, I'd stick my time. I'd get a new laptop, like a new MacBook or something like that, stick my time machine into it, press two buttons. In about an hour, it'll be up in exactly in the same condition. And meanwhile, I could get on my iPhone and check my emails on my iPhone. And it's like this guy, he loses his computer for a few days, and then he doesn't see his emails for a few days. I'm like, what the hell is going on there? And it's just time after time. It's sort of like, I didn't write down many of this, but for example, at the end of the novel, you get this final showdown, and it happens on TV. And I'm like, so it's not going to happen online, you know, because it's talking about email and Twitter, you know, nothing about Google Wave, and nothing about any kind of future communications online. Everything is sort of actually quite, you know, everything's message boards, and everything's, you know, there's a bit of Twitter mentioned, but not very much, and there's email. So everything's emails and message boards, which I think is probably a few years out of date, even now in 2009, when this novel has been released, because I think things are moving much more onto, you know, even like Dig, which is a few years old, but, you know, comments on blogs, much more, you know, a lot more interaction goes on there than through message boards and, you know, Facebook groups and stuff like that. But none of that's mentioned. It seems to be everything is still stuck in sort of like the territory of maybe 2001, where it's like I say, forums and emails, message boards, bulletin boards even. No, not quite. But then, yeah, so everything's going on. Like I say, but then you get onto TV. I'm catching back up with my notes here. And the same thing kind of happens here. It's like in Little Brother, I mentioned this at the top of the podcast, where... it's sort of like the kids with the blogs, even though like Mickey or whatever his name was, Winston or whatever his name was in Little Brother, he was like a blogger and he moved people to do stuff. But then he never really roused anything more than annoyance and curiosity. And it was only when a serious mainstream journalist came in when all the problems were solved. And then that seems to be the same thing happens here. Like the great final act all happens and it relies on the TV show that takes place. And I'm like, television hasn't been mentioned in this entire novel. It's all been online commenters, newspaper commenters, bloggers, people like that. That's been the model of media and communication. And then suddenly, when something has to have media, Cory Doctorow always goes back to the old media. And that's the only way that he seems to be able to solve the problems or to get stuff done or to actually move people in a different direction is old media, even though he's a blogger. And you'd think he would have he'd have a little bit more hope for the future power of blogging, that, you know, if enough people blog and enough opinions get out there, the opinions will rise, but then they'll be the people that matter, not the people on Countdown on CNN or whatever TV show it was at the end of this novel here. And it's a bit strange to... And maybe I'm just picking too much up on this, but like I say, in Little Brother, something only happened when they actually got a newspaper article published in the established newspaper. And here, they only were validated by a television appearance. And I'm just thinking, this is really disappointing. Really disappointing. And I thought it could be better. But the whole book seemed to like lead up until this incident, and it was very, very disappointing at the end, which I think comes down to a lack of vision or a failure of vision. And this is from Cory Doctorow. He's probably one of the most popular bloggers in the world. And yet at the end of both of the novels that I've read here, it just, you know, blogging fails. It doesn't mean anything in the end. It doesn't have an impact, and old media does, and it's very strange. Anyway, moving on now. Writing style. Like I say, it's not very good. There are some nice touches. There are some really nice turns of phrase. I'm not sure how many of them come from Cory Doctorow himself, but there are some, you know, there's two people, and they say, you know, they're sort of getting to know each other, and they're sort of, you know, they've just met, and you can sort of see something there. They're sort of, they never mentioned romance. Romance was never mentioned, or maybe romance was there all along, or something like that. And it's like, oh, that's a nice turn of phrase. And also he talks about these robots, and he says they roombered away. And I'm thinking, ah, roombered. You know, that's the new verb for the motion of small robots, small rolling robots, is it roombers this way and that. And there is actually quite a few little nice little bits here. Normally when he talks about technology, and there's some little nice, there's actually, like say, in the first part of the book, some good passages about, you know, technology. And actually throughout the book, there's some good parts. But it's overwhelmingly dull. But not just dull, but sort of like a bit sloppy as well. He repeats, he'll go through a phase in the book, like laugh lines. He repeats this phrase over and over again, but only in the first part of the book. And every time he talks about someone, to show their age and to show their character, he'll say, talk about laugh lines, which I guess are sort of like the crinkles around the eyes, on the mouth or something like that. And he mentions it like four or five times to describe four or five different people. And then he talks about later in the book, the cast members, like at Disney. Now, let me just make it clear. People aren't staff. People aren't employees. They're cast members. It doesn't matter if they clean the toilets or whatever they're doing. They're cast members at Disneyland or Disney World or whatever it is like that. Oh, and wait a second. I know you just read this a few pages ago, but what we do, we don't call them employees, we call them cast members. Oh, and let me just explain. I'm just writing this blog post, and I'm just giving it to you verbatim in the book here, because it's easy to get from one place to the other place just to write a newspaper article. But did you know, at Disneyland, they don't call people employees, they call them cast members. And I'm like, I've read this before. Stop telling me this. Just call them cast members once and I'll pick it up and then stop explaining it to me. And it just happens over and over when he just repeats these things. And also not just lines like that, but like incidences. At the beginning of the book, part one, someone says, hey, I need to get to the airport, but I need to talk to you about this kind of thing. Oh, do you need to talk to me about this? Yes, I will. Okay, well, I'll tell you about it on the way to the airport. Wait a second, you're going to take me to the airport? Oh, I don't have time. I can't have time to talk about it on the taxi. Well, tell you what, I'll talk to you about it on the plane. Why, you're going to get my plane? No, I have a private plane and you'll fly with me on my plane and I'll talk to you on my plane. And I'm like, okay, that's an interesting thing. And then later on in the book we get, I've got to go to the airport. Well, I want to talk to you. Well, you won't have time to talk to me. Well, I'll talk to you on the way. Well, it won't take too long on the taxi. We can't have a good conversation in the taxi. Well, tell you what, I'll talk to you on the plane. Why, are you going to get a ticket? No, I'll talk to you on my private plane. I'm like, I read this 200 pages ago, 300 pages ago. I'm like, why am I reading the same passage again? And it happens so many times. It's like, they go to bed. Someone goes to bed and it's sort of like, oh, he's really, really tired. He's really, really tired. And he can't keep his eyes open. He lays down and suddenly he's not able to sleep. And I'm like, and then she was really, really tired and she couldn't stay up or anything like that. And then she laid down and suddenly, as soon as she laid down, but she had a real trouble sleeping. And this person was really, really tired and suddenly laid down and can't sleep at all. And then there's a couple who are laying in bed and they're spooning in bed, and then she nibbles his neck. And then later on, I read this same kind of scene and they spoon in bed and she nibbles the back of his neck. So I'm like, wait a second, this is a different couple, but they have the same habits in bed. It's like, has Cory Doctorow only got like one position he's ever laid with someone in bed, and that's him laying facing away from the girl and the girl is spooned around him behind and nibbling his neck? Because that's all he seems to write about with two people in bed. Really strange. Also, no subtlety in the author's voice. Like I said before, it's sort of like when you've got like a bad character, the bad journalist, it's sort of like he's going, yes, you know, I'm now bad. I'm now taking on the bad part of this character. So I'm going to write in this way. And it's all sneering. And there's another thing as well. He mentions Edison. It's sort of like everyone could be an inventor like Edison. But unlike Edison, who was a ripoff, they can get credit. And I'm like going, nobody cares that Edison was a ripoff like that, but it's sort of like this is a little bugbear of Cory Doctorow. And of course, as soon as he mentions Edison, he can't mention Edison without saying, oh, but Edison was actually a ripoff, because, you know, he didn't actually invent motion pictures. It was other guy who went on and, you know, the kind of stuff. And it's like, oh, for goodness sake, and like I say, no subtlety in any of the, you know, in Cory's Doctorow voice. He doesn't mask his voice at all in any of the characters, which is very strange. I put a note down here saying lupine, which I can't remember, so let me just search for that in the text of the book. This is living in the future. I can just search. No. Oh, no, I remember what it was. It wasn't lupine. It was vulpine. Here we go, like this. He goes, this is Sammy. He goes, oh, he likes shirts that look good, and, you know, and it was a tie that was big, and he looked good. And he goes, he had shades that had been designed to make his face look a little vulpine, a trait that he'd always known he had. It put an edge Oh, sorry, it put people on edge if you looked a little wolfy. And I'm like, vulpine is fox, wolfy is lupine. And it's really strange because actually after I read that, I listened to another podcast with Mark Kermode's film review podcast, and he said exactly the same thing. I was like, wait a second, did he just read Makers and get confused? Because I've just read that in Makers. It was a bit strange, actually, the whole not getting vulpine and lupine mixed up in this book and then listening to it on another podcast. And now here I am talking about my podcast. Maybe, yes, such a postmodern world we live in. Anyway, a few mistakes like that throughout the book. I don't know why I remember now why I made a note of that. I made a note of that while listening to this other podcast. Anyway, so, and also another thing that I really hate with comedy, and I read it so often with people who, sort of like the second tier of novelists, people who you think, wow, how did this guy get a book deal? Although you don't actually wonder that about Cory Doctorow. You know how he got a deal. It's nothing to do with the writing, let me put it that way. Anyway, so he goes like this, this quote here, I'm bringing it up here. He goes, someone tells a joke, and you wanted to clutch your sides and roll onto the floor sometimes. It was so funny. The way they do it is that they say a character says this joke, and you read the joke, and you're like, eh. And then they go, oh, and the characters, and this person rolled around laughing, and they couldn't stop laughing. They were doubled up with laughing, and they had tears in their eyes, they're laughing. I was like, that's not actually funny. If you're going to write funny characters, either make them funny, or... if you're not quite sure if it's funny or not, just write the joke. And if me as a reader finds it funny, I'll just laugh and or smile or something and then move on. And if they give a good wisecrack, I'll giggle about it. You know, that's what I really liked about it. It's like nobody in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, very, very funny book. When someone said something funny, like, the whale exploded as it hit the ground and then Arthur Dent looks at it and goes, do you think we should bury this? Nobody was like, ha, 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 you're so funny, I'm rolling around the floor laughing. Oh, you are as well. Yes, this person was also grasping the side. They couldn't stop laughing. It's like, no, just don't do that. Don't tell me something's funny like that. If you're going to do funny, just do funny. Finally, I got this thing, as well, describing incidental technology in the future as though it's amazing. Technology in the future is not amazing for the people living in the future. If you're going to write about something, you've got to write about something new. Like, it's the first time they've come across this, and it's like, oh, wow, what's this? It's a light switch. So if I press this, and like, how it will go to... if I press this, this light comes on, and they're like, yeah, wow. And it's like, wow, I've lived in the jungle all my life. A light switch is amazing. However... if a character uses a light switch every day, like literally every day or every few minutes, don't then describe it in detail because it's mundane to them. You get this thing. I think I mentioned it on before on my podcast. I read a book started reading this book in about 1999 or maybe 2000 or something like that. And it was written in 1993. And it was this, I never actually got past the first chapter. I'll explain why in a minute. But it was a story about somebody who was stalking other people online and then going around and killing them or something like that. And it starts off, it's sort of like, oh, she switched on her computer and waited for it to boot up. She loaded up the connection program and logged in. No, she dialed the number and it connected with the 28K modem. And then she logged through onto the bulletin board and entered in her password and stuff like that. And again, that is really mundane, reading about what technology used to be in the past and what technology is now in small detail as though it's interesting, because it's not interesting if this person does it every day, if it's mundane. And we get this all the way through this book as well. And that's why I didn't actually read that book. I can't remember what it was called now. But after I read a 2-chapter description of someone logging onto the computer and logging online, I'm like, I don't actually need to read any more of this. Even maybe the rest of the book was amazing, but I never got to it. And that's what you get here. It's sort of like, he could have just said, he put some music on and they sat down and relaxed. But it's not that. It's like, he took his earbuds out and then he switched on this thing on the wall, and then he dropped his earbuds into this thing, and then he pressed play and selected a track, and then it's going like that. But nobody says that anymore. You just say, you don't even say, oh, he put on the CD player. You just say, put some music on. Okay, what track do you want to listen to? And it's about the music they listen to and the feeling that comes from the music that they listen to, not about the mundane technology, which is just a part of their lives. If something's going to be, like I say, something's going to be a technology, and if you're going to write about it, it has to be new to somebody in the story. It has to be interesting to somebody in the story. It has to have relevance to something in the story to describe it. Can't just be mundane. And yet Cory Doctorow describes stuff in tedious detail, which brings me on to the sex scene. Now there's quite a graphic, like an extremely, extremely graphic. Let me just do this thing. I'll search for it here. I don't really want to read too much out, because even though I don't mind swearing in this podcast, there's only so far I can go to. Let me just search for her tongue lapped eagerly at his balls. That's the little quote that I copied out here. Let me just type this in. Yeah, so he moaned into her and set her short. Again, it's just this whole thing, and it's written in the same way as somebody like this mundane incident. You know, it's not that mundane. You know, sex isn't always mundane. I'm not getting much of it at the moment, to be honest, but there you go. And but yeah, it's sort of like he turned back the sheets and then did this and then took off this item of clothing and then this item of clothing, and then with a jolt he realised that her breasts were bare and pressed against her back, going on now. He's totally awake now, you know, her lips were very soft. And he goes on, and there's just paragraph after paragraph, you know, and put his hand on his ass, discovering she was bare on her ass, you know, and it was hard and wide and he needed it digging in his fingers. And I'm just like, wow, this is really, really weird. Now, I don't have anything against sex, of course. Like I said, not getting any at the moment, but that's beside the point. I don't have anything against sex scenes. I actually quite enjoy reading sex scenes, except that I have to have some connection with the characters. And this sex scene comes about after a one-night stand, and it's like the boring guy. It's like Perry, the boring one of the makers, who you don't really care about. It's sort of like it's near the beginning, or sort of like part of the way into part two. And Perry was sort of like the boring one that you didn't care about in part one. And then he meets someone, and you're like, wow, this is just some weird girl, and she's a bit annoying, you know, this sanctimonious, like, cock tease. And then she gives this lecture about, you know, you're going to be traveling a lot, and you're going to do this, and you're going to do that. By the way, he doesn't do that very much later in the book, what she says she's going to do. And then they have this one-night plan, and it's like Miss Perfect, and then they just get together, and then there's this really graphic sex scene that goes, and it completely interrupted the flow of the novel. I didn't care about the characters. I didn't care about what was going on, and yet I've actually got to, you know, go to... she lay beside him, half on top of him, shuddering and making kittenish sounds, you know, and it just goes on and on and on and on and on like this. And normally he can't go more than like a few paragraphs without having some kind of dialogue until we get to the sex scene. And this is a massive long description. He's never talked about anything in this detail before. And like I say, it's like this weird thing. And then it's just, I say, completely out of place in the novel. He even mentions it in the introduction to the book. He says, you know, don't give this book to your kids because there's a sex scene in it. And then later on in the novel, Hilda, one of his characters says, "Holy mother of poo," Hilda breathed. And I'm like, wait a second, you just found out something bad, and you're saying the swear word that you're choosing to use is holy mother of poo. Holy mother of poo. Hilda, I know the size of your clitoris, the shape and the size of your clitoris, and the swear word you're saying is holy mother in poo. You're the slut who put out on the first night after saying that you wouldn't just because you want an easy lay, and then said that you'd do it again in the future with no problem, and the swear word you're using is holy mother in poo. Like I say, the tone of this book is just way off. It's just all over the place. I'm just going, this is weird. This is weird and stuff like that. The whole book's a bit like that. You know, the tone gets really tedious passages, loads of details and characters and incidents that add nothing to the story. It just drags all the way through. I really struggled. At one point, I was like, I'm gonna not read this book. Like I did with Fall of Hyperion. It got to the point where I'm suddenly like, okay, I'm not going to read this book anymore. What I'll do is go onto Wikipedia, just find out what happens at the end of the book, because I don't really care what happens to these characters, but I'll just find out what happens to the book. And actually, you open up Wikipedia page, and it says, Makers is a novel by Cory Doctorow. It was released in October 2009. This novel is available free on the author's website as a Creative Commons download. Next bit, external links. That's all I get to know, so that I can't even look up on Wikipedia and spoil it for me as well. Looked over on Amazon.com. There's only like 7 reviews on there, and they're all like 4 or 5 stars and stuff like that. It's just like, just tell me what happens at the end. So then I had to struggle through to the end of the book. Like, and as soon as like a blog post came up, just skipping through it, like long paragraphs, I was just like skimming through it, flicking through it and stuff like that. And I know that I didn't miss anything, because like for the few pages that I was just flicking through, well, nothing happened the rest of the time. So there you go. Like I say, you suddenly get like an essay about Disneyland. I'm like, oh, for goodness, skip that. Yeah, so bringing on now, that's the writing, terrible all over. Well, actually, terrible in the second two-thirds of the book. Themes, again, if you want these themes, just read Boing Boing, you'll get to know them. Like I say, it's all these tedious copyright battles and lawyers this way and lawyers that way, and if you want to know about the history of Disney, just read the Wikipedia article about the history of Disney. You don't need to read about it here. And then suddenly he goes on, and suddenly it's like wickedness. And it's sort of like, we can't let this wickedness happen. Like his character says to the other one, I'm like, wait a second, this is the first time you've mentioned the word wickedness. And who even uses the word wickedness anymore? And suddenly it's a fight about wickedness and principles. And before it wasn't. It was just about, oh, we've got to get this ride up and running. Yeah, this ride up and running. Oh, yeah, this copyright. Oh, I don't want to break copyright. And suddenly it's like, wickedness, they're doing this in our name and we're going to fire them or I'm going to lose all my friends because I'm making a stand against wickedness. And I'm like, right, okay. And then later on, sort of jump into the bed with the wicked. Not literally, but, you know, figuratively jumping into the bed with the wicked. And I'm like, wow, that's a bit weird. I do like some of the themes, especially in the first part of the book, like living in a slum and, you know, the, you know, temporary housing and stuff like that. But just touching on these issues rather than really going into them in depth, you know, just touching on them so briefly, it's like, that's what Cory Doctorow has done. He's sort of confused just talking about a matter with actually discussing it or shedding any new light on it. It's like he's just going, litigation, Disney, bad, copyright, bad, this, oh, violence, oh, that's bad as well, and bad luck here, oh, and being fat and obese in America, that's pretty bad, and body image, oh, that's bad too, and being a goth isn't really bad, is it? No, that's not bad, is it? No, that's not bad. And it's just like, oh, boring. Like, so again, not actually a whole lot going on thematically in this book. Well, there is. But just like I say, when the novel is a complete and utter mess, especially the epilogue, like even any kind of good stuff that could have come out of it, the epilogue sort of just goes, well, you know what all that's just said? Yeah, forget all that. Everyone dies in the end. Everyone gets ill and gets cancer and just knocks down dead in the end. You're like, yeah, that's true, isn't it? Yeah, might as well just give up now. Huh. And I'm like, that's either really subversive or just really shit. Couldn't really work out which. Anyway, I've gone on way longer than I was intending to. 54 minutes! Let's wrap this up. Conclusion. First part, really good. Read the first part. It's good 3.5-star novelette. Let me put it that way. Read it really quickly, enjoyed it. Didn't make any notes at all in the first part of the book. And again, there was stuff wrong in the first part of the book, and the writing wasn't amazing in the first part of the book, and the dialogue wasn't great. And the characters, I couldn't even remember which characters were around in the beginning of the book, but the ideas were there, and there was a bit more of a story, and there was like a journey, and they were fighting towards something and going for something, like they were in Little Brother. And I really enjoyed Little Brother, and I really enjoyed part one. And so, like I said, I think it was in The Accidental Time Machine, up to page 68. This is by Joe Haldeman. Up to page 68, great, stop reading then. That's what you should do here. Read part one and stop reading. Stop reading. Parts 2 and 3 should be burned, along with the epilogue, except this is an ebook, so don't anyone start burning my iPod. Thank you very much. I'd give this, I'd like to give it a lot, you know, 3.5 stars for that first part of the book, but the later parts and the stupid characters and the creepy sex scene, this creepy, like, ooh, Cory Doctorow has had sex like this before, and now he's writing about it. It's like, gee, thanks, Cory. Didn't really want to get that insight. Thanks a lot, man. Especially when it's like a 35-year-old guy and a 19-year-old girl or something like that. It's all a bit weird. Don't really want to read that. So it wraps up into pretty much one of the least enjoyable reading experiences this year. So I'm going to only give it 1 star, maybe 1.5 stars, because the first part was pretty good. Read the first part, but don't read this second part. So I'm going to average it out maybe 1.5 stars. And I put a note here. If you like novels like this, read Little Brother and some other books. I don't want to go on too much more about this. The next book I'm going to read is, well, I'm not entirely sure. I'll probably pick one up at the airport and read that on the flight down. Otherwise, I have Blind Sight on my iPod. What other books? Let me just quickly have a look here. I have Post Singular. No, I'm not going to read that one. I also have A Journey into the Interior of the World, into the Earth. That could be fun. I have also thinking probably going to read The Invisible Man next. That'll be my next classic science fiction novel that I'm probably going to read. So check it out. So you can follow me on goodreads.com/Luke Burridge, and you can find out what book I'm reading next or what books I've got at home or in my bag or wherever I am at the moment. I'm not at home for another month yet. I'll be back home in January. And that's a good way to do it. Otherwise, follow me on Twitter, which you can keep up to date with books and other stuff that I'm doing and photos and just general travel stuff and other stuff. Everything goes on Twitter in small town bites. Otherwise, my blog, lukeburridge.com. Oh, yeah, Twitter, @LukeBurridge on Twitter. lukeburridge.com/blog. And the video that I said on the last podcast that you should look out for, it's been delayed. I'm putting that out in January instead. Otherwise, you can check out my blog. I'm trying to post a photo there every day of my travels and some of my favorite photos from this year. Otherwise, other thoughts there as well. And I think that's about it. Otherwise, yeah, email me, luke@juggler.net, if you've read Makers and you want to take me to issue. But really, if you can defend this book, good luck. Really, I mean, I can't believe anyone could give this 5 stars because it is dreary and a drag. And I looked on, you know, and again, I tried to find out stuff on on goodreads.com, it's like, yeah, Cory Doctorow's best book. And I'm like, yeah, not really, is it? It's not really. And even if this is his best book, I mean, is it still really worth 5 stars? Not really sure. Anyway, so, yeah, email me, luke@juggler.net. Otherwise, this is probably getting on for one of the longest podcasts I've done. And, of course, it always do the long podcasts about books that I can have a good rant about and spoil and don't mind about it. Anyway, yeah, just read part one of this book. Go on, go read it. Download it for free. It's worth it. Go on. See you later.